We're broadcasting from the Middle Tennessee Electric Studios.
Visit
mte.com. Middle Tennessee Electric.
Serving to make life better.
Since 1936.
This is WGNS Action Live. Now your host, Scott Walker.
Coming your way this morning from MTSU, we have got Dr. Jennifer Snodgrass, the director of the MTSU School of Music, and Angela Tipps, master instructor in the School of Music. How are both of y'all doing this morning?
We're doing great.
Yes, nice, thank you so much here. For having us.
So a lot going on this time of year for sure.
Definitely.
What are those number one things, and what are you putting together?
Well, I mean, I think there's a concert almost every single day right now.
And a couple on weekends, yes.
Yes, absolutely. I was just looking at my calendar for this week, and there's the symphony orchestra concert coming up, so there's dress rehearsals for that, student recitals, we have commercial ensembles, and just today, after I leave here, I'm headed up to Nashville because our steel drum ensemble is performing for the National Conference for American College Presidents and Chancellors. So they're just active. And you had a concert yesterday.
We had a concert yesterday and two more after hours.
So while students who are not involved in the arts are kind of winding down this time of year, those who are in arts are really gearing up for a lot.
That's true.
Absolutely.
It's always the way it is. Yeah.
And I think with the holiday season, I've always said this, you know, they have final exams, but they also have final performances, whether it's final performances on campus for their courses, but they're also hired out at churches mm-hmm. and other organizations mm-hmm. for Christmas. Mm-hmm. You know, a trumpet player can get a lot of work.
Trumpet player's getting a lot of work. I'm going to see Isaac Swinney a lot the next few weeks.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So how many hours are some of these students putting into what they do for the arts?
Well, I'll tell you, we just got through doing the Pirates of Penzance Opera, and we had a mostly student orchestra. And so they were with me from Sunday to Sunday, 4 hours, mostly a night. And then that didn't even count what they had to do to practice their part before we got together as the orchestra. So it's countless hours, really. And all the while, they're going to class and trying to get their homework done and all of that stuff while they're performing every night.
How many of these students live on campus or maybe are from other areas? And, you know, once all this is over, they have a 5-hour drive ahead of them.
I don't think a lot of our students maybe live on campus. We do have Monahan, which is a dorm that's specifically for, or can be specifically for, music majors with practice rooms in the basement. It's really kind of a cool thing. And a faculty member that lives in a residency on there. But many of them have apartments, but I don't think anybody has more than an hour's drive, probably, would you say?
Oh, probably not. We have some that live in Franklin that commute in, but we do have students from all across the state. So when it comes time for the holidays, they will go back to, mm-hmm. You know, East Tennessee, West Tennessee. Yeah. Right. We have a few from Kentucky and Alabama mm-hmm. as well.
We do. Mm-hmm.
Now, the Middle Tennessee Choral Society and MTSU School of Music, they're co-sponsoring a Messiah sing-along. Tell us about that.
Well, I conduct the Choral Society. Dr. Snodgrass sings in the alto section. Isn't that convenient?
That is.
And so I approached her about maybe we could co-sponsor this event. For many, many years, the Choral Society, under the direction of Dr. Raphael Bundage, performed Messiah, either with the Choral Society and his student choir, Schola Cantorum, or some arrangement of those. And so that was just a given. People would call in, when is MTSU doing Messiah this year? And so when he retired from the Choral Society about 4 years ago, and they asked me to conduct, and I said, of course, I would love to. And then the question became, who's going to do Messiah? And I was very clear with the Choral Society. I did not, that's Dr. Bundage's piece. And I didn't want to do that just out of respect for him. He needed to continue to do that as long as he was teaching in MTSU. Well, he retired last year. And so, of course, everybody's, oh, what's going to happen to Messiah? Because it's such a tradition in Murfreesboro. And so I got the idea with a couple of our board members to say, wonder if we could just have a sing-along. Because I've heard that happen. Never done it. You have, but I've never done it. Where people who have sung it before or just want to come and listen, bring their scores, because most everybody that's sung in a choir has sung the Messiah, or you can borrow one from us. There's a place on the ticket where you can say, I need to have some music, and they just come and sing. The audience becomes the choir.
Oh, wow.
And so we'll have a small orchestra. That's where our ticket money comes from. That's just to support the instrumentalists that we have. Violins and a couple of trumpets, you know, because it's trumpet season. Timpani, oboes, that kind of thing, to have all of the instruments that we need to sing it. People will buy their ticket, come and sit in sections in Hinton Hall. And then the spectators, those who don't want to sing, can be up on the balcony. And we just give the downbeat and hope somebody sings.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So this is going to be the first time y'all have tried this here, right?
Yes, I think probably maybe ever, at least at MTSU. I think maybe some church choirs may have bound together years ago. But I haven't heard of it. I've been here 50 of my 60 years in Murfreesboro. So
it's a neat idea.
I hope so. You know, they're doing somebody's doing it in Nashville, like, yesterday, I think it was, but we hope that that's a different demographic than will come. We want the whole community of Murfreesboro to come and enjoy this.
Do you find that there is more talent in this Middle Tennessee area than ever before? I mean, has there been a turnover where there really is a lot more talent than there used to be?
Well, I was just talking to Angela about this. I mean, I'm in the Choral Society now, and I think there's 85 singers.
Yes.
In there. That's a very large community choir. And I sang in a professional community choir in Nashville. So when I moved down here, it was just important for me to continue to sing. Mm-hmm. But I sit right next to the tenor bass section. And I was just telling her this morning, I'm just so impressed with the tenor bass section, because they just bring it every single rehearsal. They're excellent vocalists, excellent readers. I do think the musicianship in the community is very, very strong. And I also think that the Messiah sing-along, I've participated in different cities around the country in Messiah sing-alongs. It's just so fulfilling when you see someone that, you know, sang it in college 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's such a part of the literature and the rep that we love. But to come in, grab their score, and pick up that part that they sang so long ago, I don't know. It's the best of community.
I'm a member of a book club, and one of my members emailed me and said, okay, I've got my score. Now tell me which courses we're going to do, because I want to practice some, you know. And I'm sure she's probably my age at least and hasn't sung for a while, but it's exciting.
What is life like for students who are in the arts? I know, because you said some of them have, you know, they're taking on extra jobs and responsibilities, and it's in music. But what is that life like?
That's a very good question.
Well, I think for me, our students, so many of them decided they wanted to do this at a young age. So when they come to the university, they're like, my people, you know, and they're part of that. It's just part of who they are. It's part of their identity. And so their life is extremely busy. They do not go to class and go back to their apartment or their dorm room. Once they're done with class, they're in the practice room. They're in rehearsals. They have to attend 12 concerts a semester on top of their classes. And some of them go to 16, 18 just because they want to. Mm-hmm. But it's a busy life. But it goes back to, it's part of who they are. They can't imagine doing anything else.
Right.
And I guess a lot of them, they were already doing a lot of performances before college.
Absolutely. We have so many great high school programs that are so active with musicals. A lot of musicals going on right now. And then concerts and concert assessment in the spring. Lots of things going on. And they're kind of used to it. I think they'd miss it if they didn't have that. Plus, it builds community. I mean, I'm still in touch with friends that I went to school with, which is 40 years ago.
So you may find some of these folks, you know, at a coffee shop in downtown Nashville or something on the weekend, or who knows where.
Or going to the Nashville Symphony, because they give student tickets and they want to experience that at the Skirmerhorn.
So
there are groups of folks that go do that on the weekends as well.
They're always bettering themselves in some way, looking, I guess, just to get a little bit better each day.
Absolutely.
And like you were saying, a lot of these kids, I say kids, but they started out in high school or even before that.
Yes, definitely. And there are folks who, you know, I did a concert yesterday with folks who just want to keep singing but don't want to major in it. My son is at University of Memphis and sings in their tenor bass choir, but he's an engineering major. So there's a place at MTSU for those friends who miss making music together, want to keep doing it, but they're psychology or criminal justice majors or aerospace or whatever.
And then you've got some who stand out way above others.
Certainly.
And I know we've done stories on one who, I don't think he started playing an instrument until he was about 16 or 17. Mm-hmm. But you've got some who come along and they just pick it up, and obviously that's what they were meant to do all along. This is just their first time to really do it. Mm-hmm. But how often do you come across those prodigies who are just, they stand so far out above others, it's unbelievable to hear.
We have so many talented students in School of Music, it's hard to say.
And I think one of the things I love about my job is sometimes finding those students that didn't have those opportunities, maybe mm-hmm. didn't have that amazing choral teacher or high school band director or orchestra teacher, but, you know, came to MTSU, maybe barely got in with an audition, and then they soar. Yeah. You know, they come and they learn and they embrace it all so fully. So, you know, I consider them to be some of our greatest success stories too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You've got some students who come from some very rural areas where the band teacher may also be the algebra teacher,
oh,
you know.
Oh, for sure.
but I could imagine those students especially. I mean, I could see massive change probably overnight.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Many times you'll see them. They just had never had the experience. And once you put them in, give them resources, they just blossom.
Is it sometimes just about having the right instructor or maybe putting the right music in front of them even?
Both of those things, truly. I think kids will rise to the occasion and do what's expected of them. And if you give them, you know, a diet of some really great music from all diverse kinds of styles, and give them the tools to, here's how you sing better, here's how you play your instrument better, here's some lessons on your instrument, there's no accounting for what they can do.
Are you seeing changes in the way students may mix different eras of music into today's styles, or is there even a style today?
That's a great question.
I do, but I think it depends maybe on the teacher as well, how transparent they are in allowing other things in. Like, I know our opera program does some musical theater as well in some of their opera scenes programs, which I think is important to give students an opportunity to hook them into performing. I keep going back to yesterday's concert because it's just fresh on my mind. We do a lot of different kinds of styles of music there so that they enjoy singing, performing that kind of music. And then here's some hard traditional opera that you can also do, and they do it with flying colors.
And what's the hardest music to play or hardest music to be a part of, to sing along to, or to sing, period?
This won't be popular with some of my colleagues, but I think early 20th century music is difficult for a singer because it's more like a disjunct kind of melody. It's not as maybe traditional a melody. You have to depend on ear training, and sometimes that's really difficult. And to me, sometimes it's hard to find the musicianship in those pieces as well.
Now, I'm not a musician or anything, but it does seem like somebody who writes or who sings or who performs in some way music today, they would need that background of knowing and understanding music, the roots of it, and how to put different things together mm-hmm. in order to make something sound new.
And I think that I'm a music theorist, so my background, I'm so fortunate because I get to teach all majors and non-majors sometimes. But I think that it is our responsibility to talk to the students about these various styles, but to also to help them to become their own authentic musical self by giving them those, you know, foundational tools. There is a foundation, and it's all about communication. So when we teach those musicianship skills in the framework of we're teaching this so you can communicate with other musicians, I want our graduates, when they leave, to be able to go to a professional opera company and communicate with that conductor, but also have the skills if they go up to Nashville to be a session musician, to have the skills to communicate with their band leader. And if they go in to be a middle school orchestra teacher, mm-hmm. to have the skills to be able to communicate with a 12-year-old. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the foundational thing that we're really working towards and exposing them to so much. But it's not just about writing a paper or, you know, turning in, you know, a test. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that we can really start to challenge our students to think through lots of different ways to show their knowledge through performing and communicating.
Do you sometimes find yourself learning still today from students?
Every day.
All the time. You know, I teach, one of my jobs is to teach introduction to music, like music appreciation. And every day when we talk about, like we're talking about rock and roll, that's why I've got my leather jacket on, we're talking about rock and roll today. And I guarantee you I'll have three kids who say, have you heard this piece? We talked a lot about the first country song that was on Billboard that was AI generated. We had great discussion because I've got a lot of commercial songwriting majors and audio production majors. We had wonderful discussion with those 150 kids in that room about those kinds of things. And they're always sending me, hey, I think you'd enjoy this song. It's great. It's really great. Also, just yesterday, gosh, how many? Let's just think about how many times I've said yesterday's concert. But in preparation for yesterday's concert, one of my students 2 weeks ago said we were having trouble kind of sticking with the beat. It was a real rhythmic kind of thing. And she said, could we use the metronome, which is that little click, click, click thing that keeps you in tempo? I said, yeah, let's try it. So we put it on the speaker, and it was such a cool effect because the song was called Time. That we used it in concert yesterday. We put it on the big speakers. Mm. It was the coolest thing. And I gave a shout out to Savannah Bennett because she had the great idea to, can we just sing this with a metronome once to kind of get it in our system? And it worked so well, we just kept it. So yes, I'm always learning from my singers, my students.
With AI playing a role in pretty much everything these days in some way, how do students look at AI-generated music? I mean, do they look down on it? Do they look at it with just curiosity?
Well, I'll tell you the gist of these, and these are non-music kids. These are gen ed. This is gen ed course. They were not fond of it, and they were even suspicious of how that number one status got to be, because they say that the people who are purchasing it are themselves invested in the AI industry. So
interesting.
They were a little skeptical, which I found really refreshing, you know.
And again, the concert that is coming up is going to be November 30th. And tell us about that again so folks can
remember. That's Thanksgiving weekend. So we wanted everybody to kind of start off their holiday season, because we know I've got folks who've already decorated for Christmas and I'm sorely behind. But that's the Sunday afternoon of Thanksgiving weekend. And they can go to mtchoralsociety.org. Maybe we can put it on the MTSU School of Music website as
Absolutely.
Well. That there's
there.
A ticket link that you can go. Purchase your ticket. We have some fees for adults, and then we have some kid fees, and then MTSU students and faculty get in free because, you know, they have to pay tuition. So, and then you just say whether you have your own score, whether you need the score, and then you just show up on that day, and we'll see what happens. And all of the ticket prices go to paying the musicians. So that's where that money goes. We also have, can I get another shameless
sure.
plug? The week after that, the Choral Society on December 7th at 7 p.m. has our annual Christmas program. So we're not really we're involved in the Messiah, but the one where we're on the stage has the John Rutter Gloria, which is a gorgeous piece of music with brass and organ and percussion, and then some Christmas carols arranged by Bob Chilcott. It's everything from Away in a Manger to We Wish You a Merry Christmas. So it should be a really enjoyable evening, and that's free, so you can just come out. And again, mtchoralsociety.org give you all that information.
Do you see a lot of high schoolers, middle schoolers in the audience usually?
We do, and we've actually sent out information to high school directors to say you get in free if you bring some students, you know, and to make that available to them. We've also invited some high schools to come to our dress rehearsal on that Thursday night to engage them early in the process of choral singing.
And this is all coming up again November 30th. And once more, where's it going to be on the campus when we get there?
In Hinton Hall, which is on Falconberry Drive, across from the baseball field. And I don't think there's anything going on that afternoon which would impact parking, so we should have good parking spaces. I just checked last week.
And 3 o'clock is when it starts.
3 o'clock, yes, absolutely.
Sounds good. And for anybody out there who'd like to learn more about maybe, I don't know, excelling in music, being a part of music, or getting that start in a career in music in some way, MTSU, where do we go once we're on the MTSU website again?
I would just go to the Maine School of Music webpage. It's going to talk to you about our degrees, but also our concert calendar, our faculty. And feel free to reach out to to me directly if you have any questions just about how to get more involved into the School of Music. And if you are a community member and you would like, you know, student performers or anything to come be a part of your community organization, we are really, really being deliberate about, you know, focusing on community within our school, but also community in the region and bringing music to the masses. It's a huge thing for us right now.
Sounds great. Again, Dr. Jennifer Snodgrass, director of the MTSU School of Music, and Angela Tipps, master instructor in the School of Music, both at MTSU. Thank you both for joining us.
So grateful to be
here. Thank you so much.
Right now, that time, 8:37. Stay with us. We do have more news and information coming your way next.
The Action Line on FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro, FM 100.5 Smyrna. Listen and watch at WGNSradio.com.
This message brought to you by the Central Tennessee Regional Solid Waste Planning Board. Visit RecycleRightTN.com for tips, ideas, and locations on where to recycle near you.
Don't be trashy, recycle classy, recycle right, Tennessee.
Recycling isn't just about tossing materials in a bin, it's about knowing which materials are accepted. Go to RecycleRightTN.com.
Recycle Right Tennessee.
Local farmers, local meats, vegetables, and other produce at the Winter Spring Rutherford County Farmers Market.
Bundle up and make your way every Friday at Lane Agri Park.
Hi, Murfreesboro. This is Amanda from Animal City. We're at 919 Northwest Broad Street. We have not forgotten about our reptile lovers either. Here at Animal City, we have a great selection of products for our cold-blooded friends, too. Here at Animal City, we have a full range of habitats, substrates, and other accessories. We have a great selection of products for our reptile lovers. We are so proud to be Murfreesboro's pet destination for 35 years. Animal City, 919 Northwest Broad Street. Family owned and operated.
The Action Line on FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro, FM 100.5 Smyrna. Listen and watch at WGNSradio.com.
Andrew McMahon is now with us today and in studio. He is from the Albert Gore Research Center at MTSU. So, Andrew, talk a little bit, I guess, about what you do each day.
So, I'm the archivist at the Albert Gore Research Center. So, what I do is manage the university, regional, and political collections that we have there. So I process those collections, make sure they're available for researchers, and then I also oversee a few graduate research assistants that we have from the public history program.
So one of the ongoing exhibits there, When the Cannons of War No Longer Roared, and it says the final year of the Second World War, making the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II. So tell us about that. That sounds like an interesting exhibit.
Yeah, earlier in the spring or early in the summer, we kind of realized that the 80th anniversary of the end of the war was coming up in August with VJ Day. So we wanted to do something to commemorate that. So we have a lot of collections related to World War II at the Gore Center that get used fairly often. Usually we do a lot with the Tennessee Maneuver stuff. We have a lot of material on that. But we also have a lot of stuff from veterans that served overseas, which we have not used very much in the past. So I wanted to highlight those stories. And most of those, by chance, tend to cover, you know, from the Normandy invasion in June of 1944 through the end of World War II in August of 45. So we decided to use that. I got one of our PhD grad students to help me out, Laura Headley, who couldn't be here today. But yeah, so we had all those collections from veterans that served overseas, and thought it was a good chance to highlight those.
So what types of things are in those collections?
Yeah, there's a lot of letters home, obviously. Letters home, letters from home, and again, that's one thing we wanted to emphasize is the importance of mail for soldiers serving overseas and civilians at home. So we used a lot of letters. There's a particularly good collection in the Moore Farm papers from a guy named Malcolm Williamson, and it's letters between him and his girlfriend at the time, ended up becoming his wife. And those letters span like 1942 through 45. So those were very instrumental. There was one great collection we have from a Navy veteran who served in the Pacific, and he kept a scrapbook detailing his time there. So his had a lot of photographs in it. His name was George Allen. So he had photographs from every destination or area that he served. So Okinawa, Peleliu, Hawaii, a few other places. So a lot of photographs are in the exhibit. We also were able to include the cover of his scrapbook. And the reason that one's interesting is he wrote in pen every single island or country that he sailed to during the war, along with the date. So we can kind of, you can literally just follow his service through the cover of the scrapbook. And then we also included a few other things like newsletters. Adeline King of Smyrna kept a, or she made a newsletter that she sent to servicemen deployed during the war. So we were able to find a couple of those to highlight. We also included some stuff, or we included a radio broadcast from Senator, or a congressman at the time, Albert Gore Sr., talking about the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. The photographs that you have, the ones that were taken by the actual soldiers out there, what do those look like? I mean, are those quite different from the ones the military would have been taking in order to document just the war itself?
Yes, they tend to be very different. So the collections we have tend to be a mixture of photos taken by the soldiers and then officially circulated photographs from military photographers. And the ones taken by soldiers themselves tend to be of their friends, usually their buddies in the service, photographs of themselves that they sent home to their family members. There was one collection. It was a lot of photographs of the trucks that they were driving. The guy who made that collection, he was a truck driver, I think, in the U.S. Army Ordnance Corps, if I'm not mistaken. So it was a lot of photographs of his big truck that he was hauling ammunition with, which was kind of interesting. There tends to be a lot of photographs of the different towns that they visit, especially in the European theater, a lot of photographs of these French villages. We didn't include these in the exhibit. There's one of the collections we use. He walked a lot of the Pacific battlefields in the aftermath and would take photos, and some of those are pretty graphic, so we didn't use a lot of those, but a lot of like photos of destroyed tanks and discarded equipment, things like that.
I guess a lot of stuff that people would normally see.
No, definitely. It's definitely a view of what was going on from the soldier's perspective and not from a PR standpoint.
It had to be interesting. I mean, did you get an overwhelming feel of sadness, or was there some sense of joy there? What did you feel as you were looking through these?
The Ryan papers, which is it's from a guy who served in Europe. His photos tend to be kind of lighthearted. Again, it was a lot of photographs of him with his truck, him with his friends doing kind of funny things. Additionally, that was kind of amusing to see. There's a collection from a man named Al Nagy, who served in the 37th Infantry Division in the Pacific. And he had a lot of photographs. And again, it was mostly of him with his friends. Apparently one of them had a monkey at one point. So there's a lot of photographs of the monkey. So it was really amusing to kind of see these more lighthearted photographs when the context is, you know, very, very brutal. And I'm sure very, very scary for these guys, because Nagy in particular was a combat veteran and landed at Leyte and Luzon, and he saw a lot of very fierce fighting, but his photographs tend to reflect a happier side of the story.
Did you see any of these photographs and just wonder, why are these not in Time magazine, or why were these not part of Life magazine, or something along those lines?
There were a few, particularly of Al Nagy and his buddies. in the Philippines after the war ended. There's one photo in particular. It's Nagy and two of his friends walking back to their camp from the beach. And one thing Laura and I joked about, it looked like they were, you know, about to drop the hottest boy band album of 1945. It was it looked just very, looked like three models coming back from the beach. And I'm like, that would have made a good Time magazine entry right there. And then a lot of the others, obviously, like, these guys weren't photographers in most cases, so, you know, definitely blurry, or they cover subjects that they probably wouldn't have wanted to put in Time magazine. But
it had to be interesting, though. I mean, just to see it from their perspective.
Yeah, it was very interesting, and it's the side that I like to look at the most, is from the boots on the ground perspective of the guys who were actually there.
This exhibit, is this open so that anybody could go and look at it?
Yeah, it is open to the public. It is located in the reading room of the Albert Gore Research Center. So you just walk through our front doors, and the exhibit cases are literally right there. And you can take a look at them at any time during our business hours, which is Monday through Friday, 9 to 4.
And when you're on the campus, how do you find the center?
So we are located in the ground floor of Todd Hall, which is the art building on campus. So we're on the ground floor. If you go in the back entrance of the building, which is at the Jones Hall parking lot, you go through that back entrance and we will be on the right-hand side.
And again, you can see this display for how much longer?
So this display is going to be up at least through January. It doesn't need to come down until we have another exhibit to replace it with, and we are currently brainstorming ideas for that. So it will be up at least through January.
If anybody would like to learn more online, where do we go online?
So you can go to our website for the Albert Gore Research Center. Just Google our institution name. It'll be the first hit that pops up. We do have a tab that outlines our current and past exhibits, so you can check there for the latest information on our exhibits.
Sounds good. Again, Andrew McMahon with us this morning. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We do have more news coming up next.
The Action Line on FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro, FM 100.5 Smyrna. Listen and watch at WGNSradio.com.
As cold and flu season approaches, one of the best things that you can do to give somebody who is sick is a quart of Demas's chicken and rice soup. This is Peter Demas with Demas Family of Restaurants. This soup is my grandmother's recipe, and we have used this soup in order to help our family whenever we are sick. Just gives us a good comfort feeling. One of the things that you can also do is you can now ship that soup anywhere across the United States, and you can order that soup online at DemasFamilyKitchen.com.
Woke radical liberals are screwing up this country, but Senator Bill Hagerty is fighting back. He backed one big, beautiful tax cut for working families, ending Social Security taxes for nearly all seniors, and taxes on tips and overtime gone. So call Senator Bill Hagerty at 202-224-4944 and thank him for backing working family tax cuts and putting America first. Paid for by American Prosperity Alliance.
Grab your coffee and your recycling bin. It's time for the Recycled Minute with Rocky the Raccoon, Tennessee's top trash talking mascot.
Rocky the Raccoon here with RecycleRightTN.com with a fashion tip today. Old clothes and textiles can be reused or recycled. Don't trash them. Donate gently used items to local thrift stores or drop them off at textile recycling boxes. There's places like Greenhouse Ministries, The Goodwill, and many, many other places too in town that would love your gently used clothing. So make sure those old clothes go to folks who could really use them. I'm Rocky the Raccoon for RecycleRightTN.com. Closing out today's show, the Raccoon Recyclers.
Go to Recycle Right 10. Recycle Right 10. Learn what goes in and what stays gone. Keep it clean and carry on.
The Action Line on FM 101.9 and AM 1450 Murfreesboro, FM 100.5 Smyrna. Listen and watch at WGNSradio.com.
with us now in studio, Hillary McClarty, MTSU doctoral student in English, and Tacos and Trauma. Tell us about that, first of all. What is that title for?
Well, every Friday at 1 o'clock, we have a class in the library. It's through the Writing Center, and I'm calling it this semester Tacos and Trauma. Last semester, we had pizza. So we get together for an hour, and we have a theme, and we write about it. Generally, these are deeper themes than just some kind of creative writing class. But the reason that I serve food is because I want to get a sense of community between the students, because we are writing about something a little bit more, a little bit deeper than just describing scenes and people. We're writing about ourselves. And I find that it works really well.
The trauma aspect of that title, how does that fit in?
Well, you know, I'll give you a little bit about me. I have my master's in English from Belmont. When I was at Belmont, one of my professors said, you have to take this memoir class. And I did. And when I was in that class, I thought, this is what I want to do. And for my master's thesis, prior to that, I'd also read this book called The Body Keeps the Score by Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. And in that book, he recommends mindfulness as a as one of the things that can help people with their mental health. And he says that one of the greatest pieces of mindfulness is writing. So I kind of put that together and did a trauma-informed memoir for my master's thesis. I took that to my PhD program at MTSU, and I've been focusing on trauma-informed writing for myself and trauma-informed pedagogy, teaching others. So basically what I'm doing is helping people look at themselves in ways that maybe they haven't done before. Maybe they haven't written that way before. Some people do journaling, but this is not journaling. This is themed writing. I bring in some music. I play a music video. I bring in a poem. I try to pick poems where the poet has actually got a YouTube video so we can see the poet reading their poem. But sometimes it's not possible because the poet was not around when YouTube started, but try to inspire by ways of music and poetry their writing. And we write for 10 minutes, and that's what we call a 10-minute free write, and it was developed by a man named Peter Elbow, who's one of the great writing scholarship people. And that didn't sound too good. Supposed to be an English major here. But Peter Elbow has inspired me a lot. And the point of free writing is to just take a piece of paper, whatever's in front of you, and just start writing. So you've just sat there and listened to a song and heard a poem, and then when you start writing, you're probably going to be a little inspired by that poem, by that music.
So with The Body Keeps Score, a book about how your body remembers things that may have happened to it, whereas the brain may remember, but it just can't really dictate it into words right away, but you're able to eventually. How does that kind of fit in to the writing that these students may come and do?
Well, you know, to paraphrase where he's going with this mindfulness exercise, is he's saying there's more depressed people than ever. More depressed people than ever. There's more medications than ever. There's more therapy going on than ever. And he's a psychiatrist, so he writes prescriptions for meds, and he also does talk therapy. But what he says, the missing part is the mindfulness. Where he's coming from is that not only does the body change, but the brain changes too. And if you buy the book, which is one of the best investments you'll ever make in your life, it's $10 on Amazon, you can see MRIs of people, traumatized people, and how their brain changes and how, you know, certain parts of the brain are blocked off. So what we're doing is we're opening up the brain, basically. I mean, we're doing it on a very limited level. And keep in mind, I'm in the English department, so I'm not doing therapy here. I'm not doing psychology. We're doing writing. So we're doing two things. We're helping people write about their lives, but we're also sort of exercising their writing muscle, because one thing they do in college is write. And I've gotten some feedback from some students that this class has helped them write papers in their other classes. So when I hear something like that, I feel like I'm on the right track.
Are you ever surprised about what some of the students may write about?
Completely. Completely, almost every single time, because I don't expect them to go that deep. You know, I pretty much, you know, leave it to them. And like last week, I played the song by Natasha Bedingfield called Unwritten. And it's a song about rewriting your life. And, you know, it can be anything. It can be, I'm going to graduate from college and be, you know, a doctor or whatever you're going to be. But they talked about some really deep things, about ways that they perceived the world and how they perceived it differently and how they're going to continue to perceive it differently. So, but this is, you know, 10 weeks in. We didn't start off that way. Part of the food is to create community. You know, you eat together with people. You do that over several months. You become close to them. You know their story. The other thing that we do is we write a group poem. So what we do with that is one person starts it with one line. Next person responds to that line. Then they turn the paper over. Everyone's just responding to one line. Then we read the poem. I should have brought a poem with me, actually. I didn't think of it. But the poems are amazing. And that's what we're doing next week, is we're making a chapbook for ourselves. We're going to create a cover. I'm going to bring in some construction paper. We're going to create a cover. And we do have a lot of art supplies, because another thing that we're doing is we're doing quilt squares. So quilting is a method of communication that women have been doing for a long time, forever. And what we do is we're not sewing. We're actually just writing on the quilt squares. We're pasting bling on the quilt squares, little stars, little hearts, little squares. I have glitter pens. I have pens that outline the word and then have silver in the middle. People will draw something that pertains to what we wrote. They might do something completely different and just do patterns. But at the end of the semester, my mentor, Dr. Elizabeth Myers, is going to quilt. You know, she's going to make it into a quilt. And last semester we had one, and this semester it's going to be even bigger. That is considered multimodal writing. So we've learned in the English department that there's many different kinds of writing that include art, that include these quilt squares. And it's been very effective. We can barely get it all in an hour. The eating and the videos and the writing.
Sounds interesting. We're already out of time, but again, Hillary McClarty with us this morning from MTSU, a doctoral student there in English. And real quick, is there anywhere where people can learn online about this?
Actually, no, but we are at the Writing Center in the Walker Library. I can't pronounce this woman's name particularly, but it's Margaret Obadugian, and don't ask me to spell it, but if you contact the Walker Library, you'll find the Writing Center. Just come there and any student can find out about this.
Sounds good. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
News is next on WGNS.